Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of March. Pope Benedict's unprecedented letter to Ireland apologizing for chronic child abuse within the Catholic Church took place on Saturday. There are reports that there are many people, understandably, who are still quite angry, who have accused the Vatican of ducking its own responsibility in promoting a worldwide culture of cover-up. There are, of course, new allegations in many other countries, in Europe, in Germany, where the allegations have come very close to the Pope, in Spain, in the Netherlands, in Austria. We have three guests with us this hour to talk about the way that this has been coming to light in countries all over Europe. We'll have the senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter joining us in just one moment. And both our other guests are from Ireland. The religious affairs correspondent for the Irish Times will be joining us, and the acting coordinator for the Voice of the Faithful in Derry, Ireland, will be joining us. Northern Ireland, that is, will be joining us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. John Allen is our guest, the first part of the program. He established the Rome office of the National Catholic Reporter and broke stories on Rome's response to the American sexual abuse crisis, the Vatican's opposition to the U.S.-led war in Iraq, the death of John Paul II, and the election of Benedict XVI, and a number of other Vatican events. He wrote recently, Cardinal Sean Brady of Ireland, currently under fire for his role in an investigation of sex abuse claims against a priest in the 1970s, delivered a homily on St. Patrick's Day calling for a sincere, wholehearted, and truthful acknowledgement of our sinfulness, insisting that the Irish bishops must own up to and take responsibility for any mismanagement or cover-up of child abuse. Last Saturday, a letter was read by the Pope in which he expressed shame and remorse for what he called sinful and criminal acts committed by the clergy. But he did not require that church leaders be disciplined for past mistakes, as some have been hoping for, and he did not clarify some of the contradictory Vatican rules that many are concerned about, because it would continue people to be unpunished for these criminal acts. So we talk about all of this hour. Wow, our phone lines are almost filled already. We haven't really spoken. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. That's talk@WPR.org. John Allen, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
Yes, good morning to you. Well, this is really a scandal that has spread all over Europe now. You have a good sense of what's going on. You covered what has happened here in the United States. Give us an update of what's happened even this week.
Well, the breaking news today, of course, is that Pope Benedict XVI has accepted the resignation of another Irish bishop. You may know there are five bishops in Ireland now that have submitted their resignations to the Pope because of allegations that they were complicit in the sex abuse mess in years past. One of those resignations had already been accepted. Another has been accepted today. We'll have to see in coming days what happens to the rest of them. But the big picture, Kathleen, is that what we have is a mushrooming sexual abuse crisis really all across Europe. I mean, it has obviously it exploded first in Ireland. It has now erupted in Germany. It is also in the early stages in places like Austria, Switzerland, even in Italy itself. In some ways, the trajectory of this crisis is reminiscent of what happened in the United States almost 10 years ago now, back in 2002, 2003, in which the original epicenter is one place. In the case of the States, it was Boston. But as soon as it blows up there, it goes national in dozens and then hundreds and then thousands of cases emerge in other parts of the country. But the differences here would be, I think, in Ireland, precisely because Ireland is such a Catholic country, the proportional impact is much greater because of all the institutions the church has run over the years. In Germany, of course, the explosive new element is that it also has a personal connection to the Pope himself in a growing focus on his track record as a bishop in that country 30 years ago.
And tell us about that connection with the Pope. Where is that? And could this, it's sort of unprecedented here, isn't it? Has he talked about that? And what is the way that it touches him?
Well, in a nutshell, prior to his election as Pope, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the man who is now Benedict XVI, was for about 20 years an important power broker in the Vatican. Prior to that, he had served for 5 years as the Archbishop of Munich, which, of course, is the major city there in southern Germany in a region known as Bavaria. And there is a growing spotlight now on how sex abuse cases were handled during those 5 years on the future Pope's watch. There is one case that has come to light of a priest, a guy by the name of Peter Hulermann, who came into Munich from another diocese. He had been accused credibly of sex abuse in that diocese, came into Munich for therapy. And the future Pope was informed that the priest was in his diocese. The guy then ended up working in another parish where he went on to abuse other people, for which he was criminally convicted in 86. Mm-hmm. Now, what both the Vatican and church officials in Munich have said is that then Cardinal Ratzinger, though he was aware the guy was in the diocese, was not aware that he had been put in another parish. But in any event, it happened on his watch. That revelation has been very damaging for Benedict. I think that the real concern in church circles now is that as bad as the Hulermann case is, it may not be an isolated instance. That is, there may be other cases of abuser priests who were not placed under restrictions, who were not yanked out of the priesthood under Ratzinger's watch. And if that pattern emerges, the ultimate fear is that it could call into question the Pope's moral authority to lead the church out of this crisis.
Hasn't it already, considering what's happened in the church all over the world, America, Ireland, isn't
it? Oh, well, sure. Look, Kathleen, there's no doubt that there are a lot of people who are deeply skeptical about the capacity of Catholic leaders generally, and the Pope particularly, to do the right thing. But what makes this story particularly explosive is this. From the beginning, the sex abuse crisis, what we talk about as the sex abuse crisis, has really been an interlocking set of two distinct problems. One has been the priests who abused, and the other has been the bishops who failed to clean it up.
Right.
Now, I think a lot of people would say that the church generally, and this Pope particularly, deserves some credit for having made progress on that first front. I mean, today it is abundantly clear that if a Catholic priest abuses someone, that guy is going to be yanked out of the priesthood and is going to be turned over to the cops. I think what critics would say is that the unfinished business of the crisis is that second component about what about accountability for bishops who didn't do the right thing. And the question that the Munich cases pose is, can Benedict XVI credibly ride herd on other bishops if it turns out his own record on this issue was no better?
Yes. And he was, explain this more to me. Some Irish people, church officials, have said the problem is also that there's confusion over a 2001 directive by Benedict, who was then a cardinal, reiterating a strict requirement for secrecy in handling abuse cases. It gave the authority in handling such cases to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and Benedict was prefect of the congregation from 82 until he became Pope in 2005.
Well, right. I mean, the first thing to note is that Benedict's office, the Congregation for the Faith, did not get responsibility for the sex abuse mess until 2001. And that letter you're talking about was sent to bishops to inform them that from that point forward, they were supposed to send their case files to him. Now, you're quite right that it did say for them to send those case files confidentially, which critics will see as a code word for secrecy. What the Vatican will tell you is that that confidentiality was intended to apply only to the church's internal handling of these cases. It was not meant to prevent bishops from also turning over this information to the police or to civil authorities. And I think really what the Catholic Church had, it's not so much that there was a smoking gun in Rome that ordered a cover-up. It's more that the church had a widespread culture of secrecy about these things. I mean, in many ways, it would be a lot easier if the problem was one of law, because then you can just flip a switch in Rome and make everything better. But unfortunately, what has to be fixed is the culture, you know, rather than the law. But the other thing about that 2001 letter that I think people don't often understand is that this compelled then-Cardinal Ratzinger, the future Pope, for the first time to acquaint himself with the global dimensions of this crisis, because, of course, he had to read all the case files of every priest anywhere in the world who had ever been credibly accused of sexual abuse. Prior to that stage, I think the truth is that his record, like many other Roman cardinals, was one largely of denial. After that experience, I think most insiders would say he became far more aggressive, again, in dealing with that first dimension of the crisis, that is, cracking down on priests who abused. And his record became far more overt, far more hands-on, if you like, in terms of trying to respond on that level. I think what critics would say is that it's the business of corporate responsibility on the part of the bishops, on the other hand, that remains the kind of missing piece of the puzzle.
Right. And tell me more about this denial. It seems to me incomprehensible that people who knew about this wouldn't understand how terribly damaging this was to victims of this, by members of the church, by their pastors, by people who are supposed to give them moral guidance. How come the church?
Well, I think what Vatican officials and senior churchmen 10 years ago, when this crisis first erupted in the United States, what they were saying was, obviously, any act of abuse, and particularly an act of abuse committed against a vulnerable child, is reprehensible. I mean, no one ever in Catholic officialdom has defended sexual abuse. But I think what they were also saying 10 years ago is that they simply didn't believe that the crisis was as big as we now know it to be. And I think many of them felt in their hearts that some of this was about a media and legal campaign to wound the church, and it was about grinding axes against the church for other reasons. That was the denial. Not that anyone ever thought that sexual abuse was okay or no big deal. It was rather that they thought the effort to use it to discredit the church had some kind of hidden agenda. And I think what they have been compelled to learn in the years since this first blew up in a big public way is that there's not just smoke here, there is real fire. And that's why I think the tone from the Pope today is so much different than it was 10 years ago. You may remember when this crisis erupted in the States, it took months to get the first papal word on the subject. The Vatican only grudgingly was willing to go along with a zero-tolerance policy in the United States, and there was still this kind of drumbeat of ambivalence out of Rome. Today, at least at the level of tone, that is all different. The Pope brought the Irish bishops to Rome just weeks into the trajectory of this story. He brought the president of the German Bishops' Conference just days after that crisis had erupted. He has apologized time and again. He has met with victims. So clearly, the tone is different. That reflects a new realization in Rome that this is not just a campaign to hurt the church. This is a real scandal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, critics would say that tone has yet to be matched by the actions that they believe are necessary.
Right. So would it be fair to say that it was not thought of as criminal behavior by the church 10 years ago, and now it is?
Well, I think it was perhaps not clearly understood as criminal activity. I mean, I think the tendency was to spiritualize this, to see it as a kind of spiritual shortcoming that, you know, with prayer and discipline and the possibility of conversion, you know, someone could start over. I think what they've had to add to that is a recognition that although, of course, there is a spiritual dimension to this, because sexual abuse of anyone is a serious moral sin, it is also, of course, a criminal act under civil law. And as I say, these days, the church is much more willing to acknowledge that and to cooperate with cops and with prosecutors than it was even 10 years ago.
Right. Let's take a call for you. Father Jim Connell is calling from Sheboygan. Hello, Father Connell.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you. There are two points I would like to offer, if I may. One, I am a Catholic priest of the Archdiocese and a pastor of two parishes in Sheboygan. There's a group of 10 priests of the Archdiocese. We've been organized informally in the last few months, wanting and having some conversations with those who have been victimized by priests and sexual abuse, and conversations with survivors and listening to what they have to say. We are going to this group, and we're working in conjunction with the Archdiocesan Office for Victim Assistance, Amy Peterson there, on on April 18, we're going to have the first of a series of candlelight vigils. This will be at St. Mary's Parish in Menominee Falls at 7 p.m. And our hope is to just somehow there's some spirit of prayer and God's presence among us and trusting in God as we seek for some pastoral way to try to address some of all that is going on locally, nationally, internationally. It's we need to turn the corner somehow. Second point I wish to make is, if I could, a comment concerning the Pope's letter to Ireland. I read it on Saturday. It had just come out. Frankly, I was disappointed. It certainly is a document of compassion and understanding, but I was hoping for more practical comments. One particularly concerning the Murphy report, that was a report of sexual abuse in the Archdiocese of Dublin in Ireland. Quite a report, over 700 pages, as you probably know. And there were many things made in there that I thought probably were an advancement of this whole issue. And I thought that the Pope maybe could have recognized that report, its contribution, and really asked that similar reports — that report was just of one archdiocese — similar reports be done throughout the diocese. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I was hoping that the Holy Father would have been calling for more listening to the survivors.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go to Ireland for our next couple guests, too. So, John, your response.
Well, I think, first of all, the caller reflects the kind of ferment around this issue that is out there in the church, and I think pastors clearly are trying to do whatever they can to promote, as Father said, trying to turn the corner. I think the question, obviously, the critics will raise is it really possible to turn the corner exclusively with prayer, or do you need also to adopt some new policies and offer some high-profile gestures, particularly around the issue of the accountability of bishops for mismanagement of the crisis? Their point is that, of course, there is a lot of criticism about the papal letter for what it does not contain, and I think there was a very legitimate debate to be had there, but I will simply say this. I will tell you, as someone who is paid to study papal literature very closely, the one thing that is striking about this letter is that you really rarely catch glimpses of a pope speaking as directly from the heart as he does in this letter. I mean, usually these things are very carefully couched. The language is very diplomatic and sometimes very technical and legalistic and theological and so forth. I mean, this is a real pastoral statement on the part of a pope who clearly is suffering under the weight of this crisis. And that, of course, is not to defend his policy response to it, but it is to say that it clearly does offer us a glimpse of a pope who is trying to respond not merely defensively, but pastorally. One other thing about listening, because the caller mentioned listening, the pope did, of course, he has met with victims of sexual abuse twice. He did indicate in this letter he is more than willing to do so again. I think that's very positive symbolism about how the church at other levels ought to handle it.
And just finally, a brief response. Is his job on the line?
Well, I mean, if you mean, is the Pope going to resign
under
this crisis, you know, I would put that up there at the same level of probability with the Earth colliding with another planet. I mean, is it possible? Sure. Is it likely? I don't think so. I mean, there have been about five popes over the course of more than 2,000 years of history that have actually resigned. The last one to do so was in the early 15th century, and that was basically down the barrel of a gun. So I don't think that's likely to happen, but I do think the realistic scenario is that it could become increasingly difficult for Benedict XVI to exercise moral authority on this issue, particularly, as I say, depending on what we may learn in the days to come about his record in Munich.
Right. Thank you, John, so much.
You're welcome.
John Allen, National Catholic Reporter, senior correspondent. As you know, the Pope delivered a message to people in Ireland, Catholics in Ireland, on Saturday of this week, expressing shame and remorse for what he called sinful and criminal acts committed by clergy. We're going to go to Ireland for our next two guests to get response and welcome more of your phone calls at 800-486-8655 here on the Ideas Network. Our next guest says, confronted with the greatest tragedy in Irish Catholicism, the Pope ignores the reality of decades of abuse to blame secularism and moral relativism. We speak this part of the program with Patsy McGarry, religious affairs correspondent of the Irish Times in the Republic of Ireland. He has done a great deal of award-winning work. He's written several books on the Irish president, on a lot of different issues, and he was the winner of the Templeton European Religion Writer of the Year. Our phone number continues to be 800-486-8655, and the email is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Patsy. Thanks so much for being with us. Oops, I got the wrong phone line. There we go. Hi, Patsy.
Hello there. How are you doing? You well?
I'm fine, thanks. You've been a busy guy on this issue,
yes,
haven't you? There's been a lot going on. Is this indeed the greatest tragedy in Irish Catholicism? And if so, how so?
It certainly would appear to be. And in fact, the Pope alludes to this in his letter Saturday. I mean, it was perceived that the worst period for Irish Catholicism was after the Reformation, when the penal laws became known, were introduced in Ireland, which basically meant that Catholics weren't allowed to practice their faith, they weren't allowed an education, they weren't allowed to own other than a minimal amount of property, they weren't allowed to be elected to Parliament, they had no vote, when very few people had at the time, anyhow. And that was only, those laws were only repealed in 1829, when we had Catholic emancipation. And that was perceived as being the darkest period of Irish Catholicism. But this is worse, and the Pope alludes to the fact. He says that even the persecution endured by Irish Catholicism didn't obscure the gospel in the same sense that the scandals we've been dealing with here for the last 15 years plus has done so. And in that sense, this would be the greatest tragedy to befall Irish Catholicism.
He talked in the letter about your trust has been betrayed and your dignity has been violated. What did he outline as a way to regain trust? And do you think, Patsy, that that can happen?
Well, I think we're a long way from that stage. And I mean, an earlier speaker was talking about a candlelight vigil. And I think that really, before those sort of symbolic acts can be effective, the whole truth of this issue has to come out, and the people responsible have to be dealt with, either through resignation or whatever form of censure the church and civil authorities decide to impose. We're only in the early stages, even in the maybe possibly in Ireland, in the middle of a process that has still to be completed. So it's too early for symbolic gestures, even though they may be meant with the best of heart, and I do not doubt that that is the case. Excuse me. Here in Ireland, we had another resignation today at the Bishop of Cloyne in connection with the same issue. This is a man who was secretary to three popes, secretary to Pope John Paul the First, John Paul the Second, and previously to Paul the Sixth. Now, he wasn't involved in any of the reports published so far, but there is a report or an investigation, a state investigation into his diocese of Cloyne currently underway, and it is to report by the end of the year. And so that news has come something of a shock, because it wasn't expected that he would resign before that report was published. We've had other resignations. I mean, Bishop Brendan Comiskey in Ferns in 2002, the Bishop of Limerick last December because of the Murphy report, and the Bishop of Kildare and Loughlin is due to resign, or his resignation will be accepted by the end of next month, he says, and there are two other resignations offered to the Pope, which he's yet to address. So, I mean, as I say, that's an indication of the fact that we're in the middle of a dynamic.
Right. And what about the people who are attending parishes? What are you hearing from them? Are they still going to church?
Well, Irish people have, because they've been dealing with this issue for over a decade and a half, have become quite sophisticated in the matter, if you like. They have separated out their faith or their beliefs and their practices from their confidence in the institution. But in particular, the two reports that came out last year really, really had a profound effect on Irish Catholics, and indeed the whole of Irish society. The Ryan report was approximately 2,600 pages in length. It followed a 9-year investigation into how children were dealt with by 18 religious congregations in 214 institutions, such as orphanages, industrial schools, reformatories, and the findings were absolutely shocking.
There was
widespread, epic sexual, physical, and emotional abuse, as well as neglect in all of those schools, approximately involving 140,000 children, mainly in the middle decades of the last century. Then we had the Murphy report into what went on in the Dublin Archdiocese, and it was published at the end of November, and it found again widespread sexual abuse. But above all else, it found that there had been concerted cover-up by the four archbishops involved in the period investigated and by their colleagues. And that fact, the cover-up, had a profound effect on older Catholics who never believed bishops could behave in this manner.
Of course.
They could hide abuse and push abusers around from parish to parish to protect the institution. In fact, Murphy found that the primary concern of the bishops was to protect the institution from scandals, to protect its assets, and to protect its most important members, the priests, and that the welfare of children wasn't even a factor in the earlier part of the 30-year period investigated by the Murphy Commission.
When I heard that story here in the States, it literally made me almost cry. It's almost unbelievable, isn't it, Patsy, how people could do such horrendous things under the label of religion and not know what they were doing was not only sinful but criminal.
Well, that's what really got to people, because in Ireland, the Catholic Church until recent times was a very powerful force. It was in everything. In fact, the government of the state, if you like, they controlled education and still influence there. They controlled the hospitals and the healthcare service. They were more powerful. A bishop was far more powerful than a politician. Divorce was banned in the Republic until 1996. Contraceptives weren't available until 1979. Abortion, of course, is still not allowed in Ireland. But the Catholic Church basically was a moral arbiter of this society. So it was believed by the people that the church priests and bishops were on pedestals. To discover now that they behaved in a manner that wasn't simply against Christian belief, against church law, that was criminal in terms of civil law, but outrageously immoral,
yes,
has profoundly affected people here.
Yes. Let's take some phone calls for you. Amy is our first caller for you from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I was wondering how much the Catholic Church in Ireland, or how much the Catholic Church in the United States, for that matter, is recognizing that pedophiles target the priesthood as a career, as a place to carry out these crimes. It seems that the stories that we just heard are just so shocking. They are shocking to the core. And how much is the church doing now to protect children in terms of looking at, sadly, the people who look at priesthood as a vocation? We have to consider that they may have ulterior motives. And I'll take my comments off.
Thanks,
the air.
Amy. Patsy?
Hello, sorry, excuse me.
No, it's okay.
I realize you're waiting for me to reply.
It's okay.
Certainly the church in the United States, and indeed in Ireland, has become much more rigorous in its selection of candidates and people who come forward for the priesthood. There's a period that they must go through before they're accepted for their vocation, they're confirmed. But there is also a fact in all of this. In Ireland particularly, a lot of these men, because they went into the religious orders, like Christian Brothers, etc., they went in at a very young age. They went in at 12. The men who went into the priesthood went in at 17 or 18. At the time in Ireland, people were very ignorant on matters of religion generally. It wasn't discussed. There wouldn't have been a lot of knowledge. There isn't a belief that they were as cynical as that. They wouldn't have been aware, probably, when they entered the priesthood, of their own sexual orientation or tendencies. Nowadays, any health has been rigorously examined by the church authorities when they receive an applicant for the priesthood.
Yeah, we're having a bit of a problem with the phone. Are you, if you can, I don't know if it's a line to Ireland or if you're close enough to the phone. Are you right on the phone, Patsy?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, all right, there, it's a little better now. You wrote recently, very recently, because the Pope just gave this letter, confronted with the greatest tragedy in the history of Irish Catholicism, the Pope has an explanation: secularism, moral relativism. Can you talk more about what you meant by that?
Yeah, this Pope, throughout his career, since the late 1960s, has been obsessed by what he sees as the negative influence of secularism on the Church, and that has led to moral relativism. In other words, that it doesn't agree with moral absolutism. That, I mean, if a thing is right, it's right. If it's wrong, it's wrong. It doesn't matter when, where, or what time it happened. And in fact, as prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, a position he held in Rome from the early 80s until he became Pope in 2005, he held that position. In his last Mass as Cardinal Ratzinger, before the Cardinals went in to elect the new Pope, who turned out to be himself, he warned about this dictatorship of moral relativism. And he tended to use things to further that view. Now, he does it again in the letter, and I take that, I challenge him on that in our own newspaper, that he says that one of the reasons that this clerical child sex abuse has become such an issue and has exploded in recent decades, as he sees it, is because of misinterpretations of the Second Vatican Council. But the problem with his argument is that it doesn't stand up when you scrutinize it. In Ireland, the abuse in the institutions I talked to you about earlier on took place in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, before the Vatican came about, at a time when the Catholic Church in Ireland had complete and absolute control, at a time of moral absolutism. So it just doesn't fit the facts. Furthermore, the four archbishops investigated by the Murphy Report from the 1960s up to 2004 were men of very traditional Orthodox views. They were men of moral absolute views. They were anti-secularist. And again, there his thesis falls down. And I do take issue with him using this awful Irish tragedy to simply bolster his flimsy argument, in my view. And I think it was an abuse in itself to do that, and an abuse to people who have suffered at the hands of clergy, whether they be brothers or priests.
Mm. Let's go next to Rick from Milwaukee. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you. I think there's a deeper problem here. I think the church hasn't grown out of its medieval thought patterns. Henry II, and your speaker knows this, Henry II of England and Thomas of Becket fought over who had jurisdiction over a Catholic monk who raped a woman. Henry II wanted secular jurisdiction, and Thomas à Becket became a saint because he refused to accede to Henry's request. We're still fighting this. The church apparently thinks, particularly in Rome, that these are matters that should be handled by the church and only by the church and the secular authorities. Fitting with the apparent beliefs of Cardinal Ratzinger, have nothing to say here. This is completely and totally wrong, in my opinion. Thirdly, the church, and of course, if I remember my Catholic teaching correctly, the church constitutes the people. The hierarchy and the clergy do not constitute the church. The church is guided by the Holy Spirit and is comprised of the people within the church, not vice versa. And therefore, damage to the people within the church is something that the hierarchy has a duty a long, long time ago to take care of. My principal objection to all of this is that the church has been treating this as a completely internal matter. That view of life ended in around the 13th century, except the Catholic Church seems to continue to think like that in many, many ways.
All right, Patsy?
My question wasn't intended for the original speaker, but I'd be very interested in hearing what my Irish compatriot has to say about it.
Okay.
I didn't catch everything that man said. Do you mind repeating his question?
Oh. He said that this pattern, this secrecy, goes way back. He talked about Thomas à Becket, and he doesn't have much faith that it's a long historical pattern of holding in high esteem the hierarchy of the church and not the followers, not the people who are
the faithful.
Yes.
Yeah, he's absolutely correct. It's still the way it goes on, this medieval, I think I heard him use the word medieval way of thinking, going back to history, that the church behaves as a law unto itself, and that is absolutely true. It has its own laws, known as canon law. Its concern in dealing with this issue has been with the implementation of canon law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Cardinal Ratzinger ran into difficulty over this issue, and he has in a number of instances. But in 2001, he sent two letters to every Catholic bishop in the world, both in Latin, instructing that all credible allegations of clerical child sex abuse were to be referred to him in Rome, and he would decide whether they would be dealt with there or they would be dealt with in the diocese locally. And the second letter instructed that this be kept secret. Now, this has caused a lot of controversy since it emerged, and people say this was an attempt to keep control of the matter, to keep it out of the hands of civil authorities, and have it dealt with entirely within the church and kept this knowledge away from the public at large. The church, for its part, says that it meant nothing of the sort, that the people were free to go to the civil authorities, to the police, or to the health authorities in their various countries, should they wish, that they were only there in those letters addressing it as an internal church matter. But to be fair, most people don't hold with that argument and don't accept it. As it happened, Cardinal Ratzinger was snowed under with approximately 3,000 such cases from around the world, and he eventually had to resort back to the old system of allowing the bishop locally to deal with the matter.
3,000? I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, I mean, many will feel that's fairly, that probably the figure is much higher, but that's the number that were sent to him. In fact, I know from the Murphy report that at one stage there were 28 known such cases in Dublin involving the brother, 28 priests. but that they only supplied information to Cardinal Ratzinger about 19 of them. Mm. And the ones that they didn't send information about were some of the most notorious pedophiles in the church in Dublin.
Patsy, could you comment on what's going on in Germany right now? Cardinal Ratzinger's involvement and how much, if there you can have any kind of investigation of him, will be going on?
Well, there's a huge attention now on his Diocese of Munich, where he had been from 1977 until 1982. He was Archbishop there before he went to Rome. There is one information about one case of a priest who was taken in from Essen, the neighbouring diocese of Munich, for treatment. And he, despite having a record of abusing children, was allowed into parish work in Munich diocese and continued to be involved in parish work, including involving children, up to 2008, even though he was convicted in the courts in 1986. And so that's being thoroughly investigated by media, etc., in Germany at the moment. But beyond that, I mean, there has been a spate of allegations from German elite boarding schools in Berlin and in Bavaria of allegations of abuse by priests, by Jesuits, supposedly.
They haven't been
so high in this issue so far. Approximately, I think it's 500 allegations have been made by individuals alleging that they had been abused. There's also been a spate of recent allegations emerging in Holland. There's been a book published in Italy on the same matter. So it seems to be a sort of, as one Vatican official described it last week, a tsunami of these allegations coming forth just now. And I think that this would confront the church with a major, major crisis. It already is doing so.
Yes.
And people feel it could precipitate another reformation, not one to do with doctrine, but one to do with structure, and one to do with issues like celibacy, possibly. Certainly the involvement of women at a higher level in church decision-making, maybe even women priests, but that's seen by many as a step too far, even for a Catholic church in crisis. Hmm. But there is a belief that it will precipitate major, major change in the Catholic church in time.
And that will be what, something like a Vatican Council?
Well, possibly. There is a further belief that it won't happen under in the papacy of Pope Benedict, but he'll be 83 in April, and he won't be there forever. But there is a sense that the church is on the cusp of major, major change, leading to, hopefully, to renewal.
Well, in a sense, Patsy, it has to change, doesn't it?
It has to. It has to. Absolutely has to. It's losing the people for very good reason, that the clerical church abused the people, abused their power. They were unaccountable. As we saw in Ireland, they ignored both church law and state law. And when it's human nature. People are not held to account, you have what the great British historian, who actually was a Catholic, Lord Acton, said about power, that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's what we've had here in Ireland, absolute corruption.
Mm-hmm. Patsy, thank you so much for being with us. Patsy McGarry, religious affairs correspondent for the Irish Times, who, of course, has been covering this story and calls it the greatest tragedy in Irish Catholicism. We are going to continue our next guest also, this one from Northern Ireland, Sean O'Connell, acting coordinator of Voice of the Faithful, a lay organization of Catholics who organized in 2002 as a response to the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. And they work toward achieving three goals: support survivors of clergy sexual abuse, support priests of integrity, and shape structural change within the Catholic Church. To our next guest, who will join us by phone from Derry, Northern Ireland, in just a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now from Derry, Northern Ireland, is Sean O'Connell, acting coordinator of the Voice of the Faithful. Sean, thank you very much for being with us.
Not at all. Thank you.
Tell me about how active Voice of the Faithful now is in Ireland, considering the enormity of this story in the country. It is just so awful what's happened.
Yes, it is awful. Particularly, you know, in a small country like Ireland, where there has been such a very close relationship between so many people and their church. Voice of the Faithful began here about 2004 when I was asked to coordinate people who had signed in on the VOTF website in the US. And we're linked mainly over the internet. We have about, I would think, at the moment, just about 130 members or so. As I say, mostly linked in the internet, but active in supporting survivors. We would have a small number of survivors of clerical abuse from six different Irish dioceses. There are 26 Irish dioceses in all. So we can't claim to be the voice of Irish Catholics, but we can claim to be supportive of the new structures that Patsy McGarry was talking about there that are needed to bring about accountability in the Irish Church.
Would you agree with him that in order for the church to survive here, very, very overwhelming structural changes, basic structural changes, have to take place in the church?
Yes, absolutely. And, I mean, I see signs of that developing. For those structures to take place, it requires two things. First of all, on the part of leadership, an openness to that idea. But secondly, on the part of the people, a realization that they now have to accept an adult role in their church. And that questions that they may have suppressed in the past and given clergy the benefit of the doubt about, those questions need to be asked. And we need regular opportunities for asking them, not just, of course, for asking questions, but for expressing ideas, because we have all sorts of other problems in Ireland at the moment. We have a very serious recession, 13% unemployment, for example. And there has been a decline of community with modern communications. People tend to have their heads into television and so on and all sorts of media. And we have serious social problems, including, of course, abuse, and we need as a church to mobilize ourselves to tackle the whole problem, all of the problems really that are threatening our society.
I don't know how you deal with restoring trust. I don't know how the church survives unless there is very clear transparency, unless people's stories are heard when you've had this kind of break of trust. What keeps people still going to church?
Oh, yes. We do have a very high rate of attendance at Mass,
yes,
in Ireland still. How you go about restoring trust, I think we can never restore the trust we had in the past, which tended to be entirely unconditional. You know, we tended to put our clergy on a pedestal, an unquestionable pedestal, giving them the benefit of the doubt all the time and never asking questions. I think we're far more streetwise now, far more realizing, if you like, the potential that giving power to people has for them to use that power wrongly. So I don't think there ever will be any going back to the state of affairs we had 20, even 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that's come in from Betty. Has no one made the connection between the church's policy of mandated celibacy for priests and its centuries-long denigration of women and the discovery of child abuse? This leads to distortion of personality and allows for infiltration of men psychologically imbalanced.
Well, there certainly is a problem with dealing with sexuality in the church. It goes way back to a time, I think the time of St. Augustine, when sexuality was seen as the greatest possible threat to spirituality. But I think we need to refocus that now. Voice of the Faithful has asked the papacy to review the policy of mandatory celibacy. And we've also asked the papacy to investigate the causes of abuse. And we in Ireland have asked the papacy to investigate the cover-up, to discover why so many bishops in so many countries betrayed so many children. If there is a link, it has to be discovered, and we have to march on with reforms that will take care of that.
Bob is our next caller. Bob from Eau Claire. Hi. Bob, go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, hello.
Thank you for taking my call. George Carlin had a very famous saying, the late comedian, "I was a Catholic until I reached the age of reason." And I was a Catholic until I reached the age of reason. I find most religions, but in particular the Roman Catholic faith, to be a sublime form of paternalistic rule, where the church comes down with all of these mandates and rules where people have absolutely no say over whether they make sense whether they are pertinent. They just completely rule people's lives. And by that same token, they destroyed the lives of a lot of young people by having these people, these men, who were forbidden to have intercourse with a woman, and that doesn't shut off their hormones, of course, and so they take the next easy exit, and that happens to be these vulnerable children.
Sean.
Well, number of things there. Let's take the last one. You must remember that many studies show that most abuse occurs within the home, and that many married men have practiced child abuse. Also, many celibate men live celibate lives and fruitful lives. I mean, I was educated by very reasonable and very kindly men who thought, who taught me to think outside the box, and who gave me a notion of Catholicism as many different things, including, you know, the ability to think of God as generous, and indeed liberal, for that matter. Liberal in the sense that God is a power who wishes to free us from, if you like, from those things that that threaten our lives, including the problem, for example, of vanity, which is so much a problem of the world today. So, you know, Catholicism to me is not just about repression, repression particularly of sexuality. It is also about the deep questions, the questions that we have to face about the meaning of life and so on. And it has certainly helped me in my life to understand the problem of human relationships and how we can so easily abuse one another. And in the Gospels we find an invitation to a loving and generous life, a life of self-giving. And many, many clergy, in my experience, have given their lives in a very unselfish way.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, Sean, how you responded to the Pope's message delivered last Saturday.
We were grateful for certain aspects of it. We welcomed, for example, the invitation to develop a new vision of the future in Ireland, an inspiration, if you like, an inspiring vision of the future. And we certainly believe that studying the past and looking at other aspects of it, we can indeed do that. It will need to be a vision of the Irish, for the Irish, for the future. We welcomed the recognition that survivors have much to give the church. They have suffered much pain, but they have much to give the church in terms of understanding this particular problem. We welcomed also his severe criticism of Irish bishops who had concealed the problem. There were, however, we had serious misgivings, though, about certain aspects of it. He attributed the problem of the cover-up to a decline in faith. And we saw that as an inability to recognize that there are huge structural problems in the church. For example, I mean, the abuse that occurred in Ireland was uncovered by secular processes. By media, by courts, by police, by the state. Mm. The pastoral letter itself arose out of a state inquiry into the Archdiocese of Dublin. And the Pope should have recognized that if it takes secular processes to uncover a huge church problem, that tells us that there is something about the church's own inability to discover and uncover and deal with its own problems. As it's structured at the moment, it is not self-regulating. It is, in fact, disgracing itself. This is the problem.
Mm-hmm. We have time for one more phone call. We're short on time. Tom, hello.
The number of abuses in America, I believe, is 4,000 priests and 10,000 children. In my little town, the three Catholic churches, and one priest left because he was accused of stealing $75,000. The other priest was in he was accused of abusing kids, and he was my mother's confessor. And the other church is a monastery, and we have to sell that to pay the expenses for this tragedy that's happened to us. But my question is, he was giving my mother absolution for her sins, and he himself was a sinner. Now, does that absolution count, or what happens to that?
Well, am I being asked that? Well, I, my understanding is that the sacrament is independent of the state of morality of the person who officiates at the sacrament. That can be understood very well. For example, you know, if you go in deep faith into confession, and you confess your sins, and you see the priest as the instrument that God uses to give you, it's God who's forgiving you. It's not the priest. So my understanding is that the sacrament is entirely valid in those sacraments, in those circumstances, and that you should have no misgivings about that.
When do you think this change that we've been talking about will come to the church? Is it a long time coming?
I think in many ways some of the most important changes have taken place. They're changes in mentality, changes in people's minds. I mean, even the fact that the papacy realized that a pastoral was needed was an indication of the seriousness with which it regards the problem. And now it's having to face a deluge of similar problems on the continent of Europe.
Yes.
And this papacy, you know, the Pope is now a very elderly man. There's even some talk of the possibility of retirement. And in Ireland, certainly, people are no longer paying the same attention to the authority system
yes.
in the church.
It would be hard to, I would imagine. Sean, thank you so much for your time. Sean O'Connell, Acting Coordinator of the Voice of the Faithful, joining us from Derry in Northern Ireland, this part of the program. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing such an interesting show. Thanks, Chrissy, and to Chrissy as well for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. Sorry we couldn't take tons of calls, but we had problems with guests from overseas hearing you. We'll return following the news.